Accession number 6840, rule number 1.
In July 1939, I was called up in theory for 6 months military training to report to a TA unit at Pinchinthorpe near Gisborough. Fortunately, or otherwise, I had an attack of mumps, and therefore my call-up was deferred till October 39. I received a rail warrant and reported to St. Hilda's Church at Darlington, and after handing my papers, was given a small piece of paper pinned onto the lapel of my jacket, which stated I'd joined the Tyneside Scottish Regiment. Anyway, within a matter of about 10 minutes, a chap came into the room and said, "Who was the last?" Spared into the Royal Northumberland Fusiliers. It must hold a record to be in one regiment and into another in such a short space of time. We went by train to Alnwick, which is the county town of Northumberland, and we spent the night in the little drill hall. There's 88 men, 8 men to a table, and half a loaf of bread on the table with 8 small bowls of soup and a knife stuck in the crack in the table. That was my introduction into the army. After a while, we moved on and went to France and returned with the BF with other beans from Dunkirk. Thereafter, we had a spell roamed around England, Scotland and Wales, and eventually in 1941, October, we arrived at Liverpool and boarded the Warwick Castle for destinations unknown. After approximately 6 days sailing, we arrived at Halifax, Nova Scotia, Canada, where we had a short sojourn of perhaps 2 days under guard in large warehouses on the quayside. Then, under the cover of darkness one night, we boarded an improvised troop ship, the USS Orizaba, which was an American board, but at that point in time, America was allegedly a neutral country. We slowly meandered down the American coast, and we landed at Port of Spain in Trinidad, where we refueled and then slowly coasted along to Venezuela's, refueled once again at Caracas. Then we began our zigzag course across the equator, eventually arriving in Cape Town at approximately about the 12th of December. I was in a chemist shop in Cape Town when a newsflash came that the Prince of Wales and the Repulse had been sunk. And the chemist said, "What terrible news." And I, quite gormless, said, "Oh, that's not too bad. I thought you were going to say that England had been invaded, as that was my first priority." After a stay of about 5 days in Cape Town, we sailed from Pier 232 en route and arrived at Mombasa for Christmas Day 1941. Where we found it was baking hot and a real dilapidated, decaying town. This was allegedly a major port, but in our eyes, it was just a run-down effort. In early January 1942, we arrived in Bombay, disembarking at Ballard's Pier. We got a train and went to the famous hill station of Dulali. I can quite understand how everybody talks about the Dulali Tap, because it's a really hot, deserted, isolated place. The Tower of Silence, which was quite near, a Parsi, well, not exactly a burial ground, is where the Parsis brought the dead so that the kite hawks pick the bodies. The Kaitoks themselves were a real science. We had to take great care after being to the cookout for our meal to have a plate on top of our meal, or else the Kaitoks could swoop down, remove the meat, without knocking the plate out of your hand. They were really terrific. After approximately 10 days' stay at Dalali, in which time our CO was informed by the camp commandant it was ridiculous that men should do bayonet practice on the square during the heat of the midday sun, which of course our colonel in turn informed him that the bloody Japs didn't stop fighting because of the midday sun and we'd have to get used to it. We moved back to Bombay and boarded a free French boat, the Felix Roussel, which was absolutely a floating cesspool. We got bread hot from the galley, but when you cook the bread, divisions of ants marched out. I suppose the heat of cooking the bread had made the ants' eggs hatch out. Rats and cockroaches were abound. The drinking water was, literally speaking, impossible to drink. That everybody was ravaged with diarrhoea and sickness, and there was a rumour going round that the boat was going to be turned back because of so much sickness, but of course that was wishful thinking. We proceeded with the Felix Roussel round India and approaching Singapore in, I think, with the Straits of Makassar. The convoy was attacked. The convoy, to the best of my ability and memory, it amounted to the Felix Roussel, which was our free French boat, the Reina del Pacifico, the City of Canterbury, and the City of Canterbury and the Empress of Asia. The convoy was attacked and the Empress of Asia was sunk, and our boat in particular, we lashed machine guns onto the railings of the boat to act as anti-aircraft fire for the attacking planes. I personally could vouch there was 2 planes shot down, but allegedly there was 8. On that point, I wouldn't care to make comment, but I can personally say that there was approximately 14 Royal Army Service Corps riflemen on the rails was killed, and in my platoon there was Nobby Clark, Danny Eddington, Buck Ryan were killed, George Rochester was seriously wounded, and after the attack was over, a certain Lieutenant Quartermaster came along and said, "We can do nothing for the dead, but don't forget, lads, collect the cartridge cases because they'll be useful for salvage." It makes you think the amount of equipment that was lost on Singapore, and yet we were collecting poultry cartridge cases, stepping over the dead to do so. It makes me wonder where the mentality was, or if we all had gone slightly insane. We docked in the Felix Roussel at King George V Pier, illuminated quite well by blazing go-downs, and I suppose that we didn't realise at the time, but February the 5th, which was the day we landed, we had just 10 days to go of being free men before we became guests of the Imperial Japanese Army. We took up positions at a place called Mount Pleasant, and the first thing that I encountered was a dead Indian soldier. When I reported the matter to the Sergeant Major, he turned around and said, "Remove the bolt from his rifle and leave him there. Somebody will decide and find him and bury him." I thought, this poor bugger, he traveled maybe 2,000 miles in the service of the White Raj, and all we were interested in was to remove his rifle bolt so that nobody in turn could use his rifle. While we were at Mount Pleasant, we were mortared a reasonable number of times by the Nips, and we had a few casualties. 2 nights before the capitulation, a lad called Steve Doherty from Billingham, myself and Lieutenant Tate went forward into a Chinese cemetery, and Lieutenant Tate asked me as a rangefinder to take rangers to certain objects for laying down night fire. Steve, being Lieutenant Tate's orderly, after I'd drawn a pro forma and a range card, left me and I remained, the theory being that Steve would bring the guns up to the positions and I would indicate the targets that was necessary to be fired at. When dark came and there still was no Steve, I decided to try and get back to our own lines. And while I was moving along the road, there was a blast of fire from the far side of the road, so I dropped down, shaking with fright, and shouting, "I'm a British soldier! I'm a British soldier!" Anyway, a voice shouted out, "What regiment was I, etc.?" And it was an officer that was in charge. I think they were either Baluchis or Gawalis. And the password through their lines was TK. Well, I can assure you that TK was never repeated so often in such a short time in my lifetime. I eventually got back to our lines and found I had a bullet wound in the thick of my leg, but of course that was of very little consequence. I got back safely. But I found that after the episode I'd gone through, a lot of our allegedly brave NCOs was in foxholes, and even one hid underneath an ammunition truck. I sometimes wonder if Singapore hadn't capitulated, what kind of a show we would have put up. On the night before the capitulation, we set up machine guns to fire onto fixed lines. And the Japs attacked, and there was Lance Corporal Robinson, Lance Corporal Craven, Lance Corporal Suggett, Sedgwick, were killed, apart from Jack Nutman and a few more of the Fusiliers. After the attack had died down, Sergeant Kinghorn told us that if anything moved in front of the guns, not to hesitate to fire on fixed lines. And somehow or other, the idiot went to sleep in front of the guns, with somebody seeing something move and open fire, and he was wounded. But it was not by the Japanese, it was by our own guns. This man was one of the misfits of being a sergeant. An episode appertaining to him was when we were at Keppel Harbour as a prisoner, we still maintained military discipline, and he in turn was calling the company roll. And a chap called Hans H.V. had been left in Cape Town as he'd been stabbed by going to the forbidden area of District 6, and of course in consequence was left in Cape Town, but his name was still remained on the company roll. He called the company roll, and when Hans H.B. didn't answer, he turned round with a quite straight face and said, "Will anybody here, when they see Hans H.B., tell him he's on a company charge for not being on parade?" Now, that was the mentality of one of our sergeants. The morning of the 16th of February was when we knew the capitulation had taken place. And a little Jap soldier, about 5 foot nothing, but the combination of rifle and bayonet was equally as tall as he was, came along to our section saying, "Shoot, shoot," and we went into the bag. We were told that all we could take was what we could carry, and we had to march to a place called Changi, which personally didn't mean a thing to me at that point in time. Anyway, after we'd been marching perhaps 3 hours to our destination, in the heat of the sun, I personally was so parched. A number of Indians were sat and squat round about watching us go into captivity. I called to one of them, "Pani Johnny," and he disappeared and came back with a pint mug with some clear liquid in, which I was so parched I just quaffed off straightway. And the next thing I remembered was arriving in Changi. I suspect that what he must have gave me was plenty of half pint of gin, which I'd drank off, and that's as far as I remember. The next thing I recall was waking up in Changi. So that was the beginning of my free power existence. I was only in Changi a few days when I took dysentery. I was so weakened and having so many emotions, I just laid outside the latrines. And when I eventually seen the MO and he asked me what I thought was wrong with me, I said I thought perhaps dysentery, as I was having approximately 48 motions per day. I described my symptoms to him and he turned round to his orderly and said, "An excellent description of dysentery, tenant. Give this man a good dose of Epsom salts and that should clear him out." Fortunately for me, it did clear me that whether I had dysentery or otherwise, I just don't know. On returning back to the hut where I was allocated, I always recall Steve Doherty and a lad called Johnny Cummins had looted a bed from some civilian house, and seeing the army always stipulated no two men slept in one bed, they had a plank lashed along the centre of the bed. And Johnny Cummins, he also took dysentery and went into Robert's Hospital. So Steve, ever enterprising, hung a notice up on Johnny Cummins' half of the bed, half a bed to let. And there was a lad called Lou Ryder. He came from Derby. He was a great storyteller. And he invented characters which fit characters in the hut. There was the One-Eyed Glee and Buck Jones and several characters like that which he made up cowboy stories about. He was a real character, but whatever happened to him, I have no knowledge whatsoever. After about a fortnight, we moved on to Keppel Harbour for to begin our labours as dockers. While we're at Keppel Harbour, improvisation being the necessity, we found wire steel bars which we bent and wire chicken wire and we made beds with, and they were really springy and comfortable. We had steel plates which we made into dining room tables, and really we weren't too badly at all at Keppel Harbour, but there's lots of things happened while we were there. We found, first of all, that as we marched off to work onto the docks, we had to pass the Jap guard room. And therefore, we had to acknowledge the Jap guard by obeying the commands in Japanese, which invariably was Kashramigi, which means eyes right. But our colonel, Flower, was a man about 6'6" to 6'8" in height, known by the Japs as a 2-meter man, always stood and obliterated the Jap guard commander, taking the salute. And after the command, Kashramigi was Adari, meaning eyes front. But invariably, whoever was in charge of the different sections used to shout, "Look at the bastards, they've had it." Which the Japs never seemed to realise we'd taken the mickey from them, even in those early days. But one particular morning, when we were marching off to work, I had torn my shorts. Now that in those days, we were equipped with shorts and shirts. And Colonel Flower, he seen this section that I was in, and he halted it, took me out, took me to the guard room, and indicated that my shorts, were torn. And he said to me, "Corporal, don't forget, you're a white man in a black man's country. Never let the sign down." But I'm afraid that the sign was let down several times as time went on. One of the episodes I remember while working at Keppel Harbour, we were loading oil drums, and of course with our hands that were filthy, dirty, and a Jap gave some of the lads a Union Jack to wipe their hands on. and a certain corporal from HQ Company, he waved his hands on it, and I, in turn, had worked with him, and it was one of the three fights I had as a peepal. Needless to say, I came up worse in each of the three. But I was so infuriated that we should stoop low enough to wipe our dirty hands on the Union Jack. But of course, as time goes on, you lose these scruples. I recall a Japanese boat, the Titum II Maru, coming into Singapore. It was repatriating Japanese nationals. And Colonel Flower, he stood on the pier end with a huge Union Jack, waving it like billy-o as the Japanese nationals in turn were waving their little tiny Japanese flags. And we were chalked up, we were told off about it because a Japanese officer came to the camp on a white horse, and the interpreter, a Captain Sanderson of our unit, with him. And as he galloped into the camp, Sanderson was running alongside him shouting, "Bow, you buggers, bow." That we had to kowtow to the Japanese from the very beginning. The only fortunate part may have been that our camp commandant at that point in time was allegedly a friend of Prince Konoye of Japan, in turn, who was a curator, I understand, of Whipsnade Zoo, a honorary title. But Colonel Flower's brother also was something to do with Whipsnade Zoo. And while we're at Keppel Harbour, we got reasonable treatment. In fact, where rice was concerned, we got more rice than we could cope with. And when we were issued with limed rice, which had been treated to preserve it, at night, we furiously tipped it over into the dockside because it was most vile stuff to try and eat. As I have mentioned about Colonel Flower being so tall and the Japanese being so small, when we were on the docks working, if they wanted to humiliate Colonel Flower in front of any of the Malays, Chinese, etc., they used to gently stand on a bollard, call him across to slap his face, because otherwise they were too small to reach up to his face. Or the other trick they used to do was to kick him at the backside, and when he bent down, in turn, they slapped his face just to cause some humiliation to him. But I can honestly say that Colonel Flower was one of the greatest peepows, apart from a Sergeant Major Wilson, who I ever encountered. While helping to unload the Titan to Maru, a lad called Ingledew, who came from Martin Road, Middlesbrough, met a chap that, literally speaking, was his next-door neighbour. And this chap blandly informed him that ICI had been bombed and Dormans and Middlesbrough was absolutely raised to the ground, which of course didn't put us in very high spirits at all. But of course, there again, that was just malignant gossip for the depressors, which he certainly did achieve. While we were at Keppel Harbour, of course, we became some of the greatest looters in the world. We stole all and sundry. The main punishment being, if the Japs caught us, was they invariably made you either eat or drink whatever you'd stolen. If you stole palm oil and you had to drink it, well, of course, you had dire consequence. Sugar was quite okay. It was no hardship to eat raw sugar. But if you caught stealing tobacco or cigarettes, heaven help the poor lads that used to try and have to eat the cigarettes. They must have had a hellish undertaking. At Keppel Harbour itself, go down 20, which was one of the arms of our prison camp, was laden with different tin stuffs, and invariably at night we used to sneak across and help ourselves, because the Japs got wise to this. And they laid in wait one particular night, and two lads, I think they were from the Cambridgeshire Regiment, were shot dead as they came out the go downs. And of course, that was the end of our looting as far as go down 20 was concerned, but it did not stop us from looting on the docks, which we still carried on. While at Keppel Harbour, a ration truck was coming in one day and it skidded off the roadway into the water itself, which wasn't really deep at that point. Anyway, a chap called Wanty dived in and rescued the Japanese driver. So, in turn, we were rewarded with a day's holiday and extra rice and meat ration. Well, the rice didn't mean anything because we had loads of that, but of course the meat was greatly appreciated. So the cookhouse pledged that the bakers a huge meat pie to be divided between 12 men. So one man stepped forward and 11 formed up behind them to collect these meat pies. Anyway, one of the chaps dropped the meat pie, and of course the other 11 nearly died a mortification at the sight of it. But the quartermaster sergeant, a chap called Gregory, quite blandly turned round and said, "How fortunate we've baked some extra pies." Of course, needless to say, had it not happened, the extra pies in all probability would have went to feed the cookhouse staff and the hangers on the favoured pew. While at Keppel Harbour, military discipline was still maintained, and anybody that transgressed was put in the cage, where in normal circumstance, I understand, the customs used for bonded goods. So although we were prisoners by the Japanese, we still could be imprisoned by our own fellow NCOs. But Keppel Harbour itself, really, was a reasonably pleasant place, because we could use the showers which the dockers had previously used. And when we were at Keppel Harbour, we noticed a strange phenomena that it could be blazing hot and there appeared to be a cloudless sky, but suddenly a cold wind would spring up and you could gamble within 20 minutes at least after the cold wind you got a torrential downpour. But don't let me give you this impression that Singapore suffers from monsoon. They don't, not to my knowledge. And the other phenomena that we noticed was, with Singapore, it got dark at 6 at night and light at 6 in the morning, and there was very, very little twilight and very, very little dawn. Incidentally, the chap, Wanty, that rescued the Japanese driver on New Year's Eve 1944 in Thailand was shot dead by a Japanese officer who had been celebrating the fact that all Japanese officially become 1 year older on the first day of the new year. It's rather ironic a man should lose his life in some years after rescuing a Japanese from certain death, but that's the way the cookie crumbles. Got some strange instances while at Keppel Harbour. One of them that sticks in my mind was we'd reported to Maxwell Road Police Headquarters, where there's a large car compound, and while we were sat around waiting to be told as to what job we had to do, a Japanese soldier came along and said to three of us, "English, Sue?" And we said yes. Incidentally, I had very fair hair, bleached with the sun. Corporal Smith was ginger, and Andy Elliott was known as Black Amber, the reason being of his jet black hair plus his yellow features. And when we said yes, we were all English, Sue, he beat us all up and then ranted on, telling us that all Nippon were anaji, meaning they were all the same, therefore they were all black haired and yellow features, whereas we in turn were each different. So thereafter we learnt our lesson and we invariably became either Irish, Welsh or Scots, but never all English, though. It saved a lot of beatings and a lot of embarrassment trying to explain as to why we should be different where Japanese were all pretty much the same.